It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When the August Wilson Center for African American Culture opened in 2009, there was hope and optimism about a rich community asset in the heart of downtown Pittsburgh. But some financial troubles plagued the development from the start, leading to bankruptcy and nearly foreclosure. A foundation-led coalition purchased the building in 2014 and temporarily turned it over the center's operations to the Cultural Trust. The president and CEO is Janice Burley Wilson. She took over during its upswing just over a year ago. Janice Burley Wilson, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, Janice, where's the center in terms of on the road to fulfilling that original optimism that I mentioned?
I think that we are well on our way. We have had a great first year with with my
leadership,
my role as the president and CEO. Prior to that, in my time at the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust, I was responsible for the programming the last 2 years, and so we got a great head start. Have a lot of really exciting programming that brings people from around the country with Pittsburgh International Jazz Festival, the upcoming Highmark Blues and Heritage Festival. But we also have programming that's happening on a regular basis that is attracting a really broad cross-section of the local, the regional community.
You've been creating, developing, supporting cultural events in Pittsburgh for about two decades, from gallery crawls to the annual Pittsburgh Jazz Live International Festival, including programming, of course, at the August Wilson Center. How have all those experiences that you have put together over the last couple of decades, how have they helped you see the potential for the center?
Well, I've said this many times. I think that I'm in the right place at the right time for the August Wilson Center. The last, as you said, close to two decades, I've been doing a lot of different kinds of work and working with a lot of different segments of the local community, the arts community. And so I have a lot of experience in developing programming that will appeal to the local audience, not just the African-American community, but the entire community. And that's been one of our goals at the August Wilson Centers, to present work that is definitely in celebration of the African-American experience and art of the African diaspora and culture. But we find that our audiences are extremely diverse, extremely broad for the majority of our programming.
That must be very pleasing.
It's very pleasing because I personally don't believe that the August Wilson Center, or really any cultural organization or arts center, can survive without broad support from the entire community, and we're getting that. We're getting broad support from the local foundation community, who's been extremely generous, as well as the corporate community and just people on the street that are going to the August Wilson Center for a variety of programs.
It's meant to be a sharing of talent, of skills, of learning, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how are you tapping those relationships, those connections you developed over the last 20 years in formulating and continuing to strengthen what's happening at the center itself, both financially but also programmatically?
Well, first, let's start with programmatically speaking. I have a lot of relationships with the local arts community. For example, there's a fantastic, talented dancer, Greer Reed, who I've worked with over many, many years. And actually, she had a dance company, the Reed Dance Ensemble, at the August Wilson Center many years ago. She and her dancers are offering weekly dance classes at the August Wilson Center for a variety of people. When you show up on a Wednesday night for dance class, there's a lot of different types of bodies in the room and a lot of diversity in the age and just the people that are attending. We work with groups like Pearl Arts, which is another dance company. We work with Hill Dance Academy, which is a dance company that's based in the Hill District that offers classes and workshops for young people, and Afro-American Music Institute, the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. We're working on some different things, different programs with them. And so it's really rewarding for me to see all of the different segments of the community coming into the August Wilson Center for their own programming and also to support the programming that we are developing there.
All right. I think we got a sense now of what excites you. But if you'd like to add, what does excite you about the center and its potential, but also what frustrates you a little bit? What do you, you know, say, come on, we got to do this sooner rather than later?
Right. Well, what excites me is the impact that we're able to make when you have a family that will visit the August Wilson Center on a Saturday afternoon to see the galleries, and you have young people running through the galleries and looking at the art and reacting, and we see those positive responses. And then the families leave, and then we see them return. And that's what we want. We want the August Wilson Center to be a center or a hub for cultural expression and for people to gain exposure on the different types of art and culture that's available to them. But what frustrates me, I guess, is that we want to do so much. I'm only 1 year in my role, and I have a lot of things that I want to do. And so I'm trying to be very careful about pacing. Mm-hmm. One of the things that, one of the issues that concerns me is growing the organization too fast, too soon. Right now we have great support, and we're able to accomplish a lot programmatically. If we were to double our staff in the second year and, you know, add a lot of new capital projects on, then, you know, then right. Next year we might be talking in your studio and you have a different story to tell.
Right.
But right now we're in very good shape, and gaining support for corporate support for a lot of our different programs, which is exciting. So we have those corporate sponsors that are returning. And they're excited about supporting the August Wilson Center. So there's a lot of buy-in in the idea of an African-American cultural center or a cultural center that celebrates the very broad cultural gifts of the African diaspora. But we're seeing those corporate sponsors return, and they want to support the variety of programs that we're presenting.
Well, let me follow up on that. When you were hired, you were charged with delivering programs that enhance the center's image, mm-hmm. but also developing a business plan to get more funding. Mm-hmm. Have you, or is that a chicken and an egg kind of thing? You got to prove yourself first before you get the financial, or is it, no, we know that you can do it, we're going to invest now so that you can deliver on what we know you can?
I think it's a little bit of all of that. Someone referred to my first year as a president and CEO of the August Wilson Center as building the plane as we're flying it, mm-hmm. which makes it's very apropos, because we have all these programs happening as we were building staff. On my first day at the August Wilson Center, I walked through the doors with one person, and we had concerts and visual arts exhibitions and different things that were happening. And then we slowly added additional staff. At the same time, I was sending proposals to corporations and having meetings, and corporate sponsors were taking risks, basically saying, we know you, we remember your work, and we're going to take this risk with you. And luckily, we've presented some great results. The Pittsburgh International Jazz Festival this year was probably the best ever. Really great attendance, excellent programming, and we were able to expand the footprint by moving from Penn Avenue in Pittsburgh's cultural district to Liberty Avenue, which is a wider street, and it was jammed with all different kinds of people from all over the country. And so our lead sponsor for the Pittsburgh International Jazz Festival is Citizens Bank. They were thrilled, and they've already signed on to support next year, which is wonderful.
Yeah, you obviously, anybody knows, you know, you have an affection for jazz and appreciation.
Yes, I do.
What needs to be done to inspire a strong future, though, for Pittsburgh jazz?
I think there are a lot of really great local advocates for the music. You have Bob Studebaker, who's here at your station. You're so lucky to see him every day. I think he's a gem. And then you have others that are developing different programs like Lighthouse Arts Project with Dr. Harry Clark and Tom Wint. You have the Afro-American Music Institute, which right. is doing great work in developing the future jazz musicians that will lead the way. And we are developing a jazz series at the August Wilson Center. We have Diane Reeves, who will be with us in November. Sean Jones is writing a special suite of music to support a visual arts exhibition that we have opening in October. And so we will continue to grow the Pittsburgh International Jazz Festival and broaden our support for that event as well.
When you were named as president and CEO of the center, you said your goal was to take it global. Where are you on your way to that goal? And sort of how do you mesh that, bringing in that international, exposing this Pittsburgh region to that international talent, while also highlighting some of the local talent as well?
The August Wilson Center is the only one of its kind. There's no August Wilson Center anywhere else in the world. And August Wilson's name resonates globally, just as Andy Warhol's name resonates globally. And we feel very fortunate to have that name associated with the building that we where we hold all of our programs. We're working closely with the August Wilson estate. August Wilson's widow, Constanza Romero, is very pleased with what she sees so far, and she will be helping us to develop a dedicated space that honors August Wilson's legacy. We have a lot of his personal belongings in the building right now, his writing desk. We have a number of the props from the Broadway productions, and we are going to be working with a local tech firm to develop this interactive installation around August Wilson's work that will attract people globally. And we also have a Global Arts Advisory Council that includes people like Harry Belafonte, Angelique Kijot, Esapetha Murkison, Pittsburghers like Kyle Abraham, LaToya Ruby Frazier, Smokey Robinson, and others that will take the name and the conversation of the August Wilson Center through globally within their networks.
We have less than a minute left. I wanted to ask you, you know, for a time there, the center felt like it was a building to rent. Mm-hmm. I remember one headline, The Rise and Fall of the August Wilson Center. Mm-hmm. Has it completely risen again?
Completely risen again. We're on our way.
Okay. And one of those things that are on your way, something that's coming up is, if you would, very briefly, a fantastic, an eye-opening exhibit you've got coming up.
Yes. It's called Familiar Boundaries and Infinite Possibilities. It's a group show. There are 12 local, not some local artists, but 12 artists that are really important and on the rise. But it's specifically, there is an installation called Flying Girls by a Nigerian artist named Peju Alatize. And it's a collection of sculptures that tells a story of young girls in Nigeria who would love to be little girls but are often sold into child labor by their families. It's stunning. I can't wait for everyone to see that.
And that's when?
And that's opening on October 12th.
And goes for several
months? Goes through March 20th. So there are a lot of opportunities to see that piece.
Janice Burley Wilson is the president and CEO of the August Wilson Center. Janice, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
The financial crash of 2008 involved a lot of greed, fraud, and poor judgment. But there was some tech in there as well. Coming up on Marketplace Tech, the software that helped topple the economy. That's next when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the first two branches of the Community College of Allegheny County opened on Pittsburgh's North Side and Monroeville in 1966. Just a few years after the statewide Community College Act, officials began crafting a plan to build higher learning facilities in the region. More than 1,500 students enrolled in the school's inaugural semester, with 16 part-time faculty members. Currently, CCAC has more than 150 programs on four campuses and four neighborhood centers, offering students affordable courses and multiple opportunities to transfer credits. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac for September 17th, 2018.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. From classical to bluegrass to country and jazz, music is a universal language essential to the growth and maturation of the mind. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook reports that's the theory behind Pittsburgher Devin Arrington's work with Musicians with a Mission.
I always enjoyed playing in healthcare facilities, like a lot of people, I would try to find ways to use my musical gifts. It's so important to me to try to express clearly the passion I feel for what I do,
As a professional violinist who started playing at the age of 2, Devin Arrington is also a composer and instructor. And with the organization Musicians with a Mission, where he serves as founding director, he leads a group of fellow musicians who play in assisted living nursing facilities around Pittsburgh. Arrington says the seeds of the program were planted during his formative years.
As a teenager, I went and played for a man who had had a severe stroke, and his wife was now his caretaker. And he almost didn't speak at all. He just sat in front of the TV most of the time. And when I finished playing, he looked at me and he said, "That was beautiful." And his wife started tearing up, and she said, "He's never spoken those words."
In a 2011 paper commissioned by the Music Connections Program of Carnegie Hall's Weill Music Institute, it describes how music works across a person's lifespan to develop, protect, and repair the brain. Arrington says for many who lead a sedentary lifestyle, the live performances help mentally and physically stimulate those who engage in the activities.
It's very healing. Very uplifting.
Soprano singer Rosemary Pavlovsky is one of over 30 musicians who participate in the program and says it's uplifting for her as much as the residents.
I absolutely love this work. I'm so passionate about it because these people deserve good music, and I believe in a therapeutic quality to music. It's healing. And many of these people, they're very highly educated too.
Using music, the language that speaks to all races, genders, and socioeconomic backgrounds, is what she says brings people together. Her role with Musicians with a Mission is one she feels will be an integral part of her life for the foreseeable future. Pavlovsky says the organization's impact is real and lasting.
Devin's one of our area's greatest, and he also has obviously a very big heart, and he saw a need for it, and I agree with him 100%.
I expected it to be wonderfully received by the residents, but what pleasantly surprised me is how much it meant to the musicians too. I continue to get feedback from musicians, including ones that have recently joined us, that just gush about how much it means to them to take something that they've worked so hard at all their life and to see it bearing fruit, to see the smiles on the faces of the residents, and to have that one-on-one contact.
His hope is that the work of spreading live music in nursing facilities will expand far beyond Western Pennsylvania.
My long-term vision was always that Pittsburgh could act as a model city for what could be in the future in other cities.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Some might say, what took so long? Republican Keith Rothfuss has aired the first attack ad in the 17th Congressional District race.
Who is Connor Lamb protecting? A mouse. Lamb voted to spend tax dollars protecting mice. Seriously. Protecting us, Keith Rothfuss, for Congress.
Joining me in studio is WESA's Politics and Government Accountability Editor, Chris Potter. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
So what's this about a mouse?
Yeah, I guess Rothfuss has given up on the rodent demographic in his reelected attempt here. Yeah, this is a new ad, and it faults aired by Republican Keith Rothfuss against Democrat Connor Lamb in the 17th Congressional District, as you mentioned. And this is one of several attacks lodged in the ad. There are a series of accusations that Lamb is working to take funding away from Medicare. There's some stuff about prescription drugs and so on and so forth. And this is kind of the coup de grace of the ad, I guess, which is that he took a vote to defend mice. And the Rothfuss campaign says specifically that's referring to a vote that Lamb and pretty much every other Democrat in the House took related to a mouse that is indigenous to Colorado and Wyoming called the Preble's Meadow Jumping Mouse. This mouse is yes, as I'm sure your viewer, as I'm sure the audience knows, this mouse has been at the center of a lot of conservation debates in that part of the country for a long time. A few months ago, the mouse was allowed to remain on the endangered species list over the objections of some developers and property owners out there. And there was an effort by a Republican House member from that area to basically say the federal government can't spend any money related to the efforts to protect this mouse. And Lamb and the other Democrats voted against that.
So the gist is Connor Lamb is not protecting the right creatures, at least from the Keith Rothfuss perspective.
Right, exactly. And this is the kind of thing, we've seen this. What's sort of surprising about this ad is in a season where, in a year where we've seen so many ads targeting Connor Lamb for supporting Nancy Pelosi and opposing Republican tax cuts, the stuff that was so much a part of that special election, this feels like kind of an old school kind of thing where you pick that one vote out of 100 votes or whatever that just looks weird or can be made to sound weird on the air, and then you attack the guy over that vote.
All right, so the Rothfuss campaign is also using the L word, and I'm not referring to Lamb. They're use the L word in this case, liberal.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So that's and you can see that's where this is going to go. The one thing that's interesting to me is they want to say, because now we've had Connor Lamb in office since March, and they want to basically say, hey, you might have voted for this guy in that special election back in March when he was just a former Marine and all that other kind of stuff. But now he's got this voting record and you need to know what a liberal he really is. And I have a feeling that's what we're going to hear in these final weeks before the November election.
According to Mike Barley from the Rothfuss campaign, he said that Lamb has spent the last year trying to convince voters otherwise that he's not a liberal, even going so far as brandishing a high-powered rifle in an ad. Quote, but his efforts don't pass the smell test. But to the Rothfuss campaign statements claims pass the fact-checking test.
Well, a lot of these things are true as far as they go within the four quarters of the script, but there needs to be broader context. So one of the things Lamb is faulted for was voting, as the ad puts it, as to protect sanctuary cities. And that was part of an immigration bill that Democrats voted against, and so did about 40 more moderate Republicans. This bill failed. It was a hardline immigration bill, very, very stringent, and it did have some language that would have punished what are called so-called sanctuary cities, where they limit their cooperation with federal immigration authorities. He did take that vote. It's also worth perhaps noticing that earlier this year, Lamb also took a vote which upset a lot of liberals and progressives. There was a resolution commending the hard work that our ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office, does. Most Democrats, when that came up and it was just like, we, the Congress, honor the noble service of this branch of the law enforcement. Most Democrats just voted present, neither aye nor nay, neither yes nor no. Connor Lamb was one of just a couple of Democrats who voted yes for that. And I asked him why, because a lot of the more activist base in the party was pretty disappointed with him. And he said, I've always been a law and order guy. I was a federal prosecutor before I did this. So, I think he has very carefully. I mean, Connor Lamb knew when he got elected in March, he knew when he won that race, that his voting record was going to be scrutinized very, very carefully between then and November. And I think he's taken a very calibrated approach as to how he positions himself on these issues.
Our last 30 seconds or so, Chris, what else are you going to be looking for in this campaign over the final 7 weeks?
Right. Well, I think one of the things we'll be looking for is whether there are more ads like this. It's significant that this ad was paid for by Keith Rothfuss, the Rothfuss campaign itself. Folks will remember there were a lot of ads targeting Connor Lamb back in the special election, but they were paid for by outside groups. And one of the big questions right now is, will these outside groups bid to this race or not? They have sent mixed messages. The National Republican Campaign Committee has reserved airtime, but then delayed the actual their actual plans to air ads. There have been talk about making investments in this district, but it's sort of an open question as to how involved national Republicans will get.
Chris Potter is WESA's Politics and Government Accountability Editor. Thanks as always, Chris.
Always good to be with you.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 10 years ago, lawmakers passed the Clean Indoor Air Act, making Pennsylvania the 28th state to prohibit smoking in public places and most workplaces. Has it worked? Is the indoor air cleaner? Are further restrictions needed? We're going to talk about all of that with Tiffany Babinczak. She is the program coordinator at Tobacco Free Allegheny. Welcome, Tiffany.
Thank you. Welcome.
Also in studio is reporter Hal Klein. He covers the restaurant scene in the region for Pittsburgh Magazine. Good to see you again, Hal.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me back.
All right. So before we talk about going forward and maybe amending the 10-year-old law, let's back up a little bit. Before the legislation was passed, there was a lot of give and take, but also pushback from the hospitality industry. Hal, Tiffany, weren't they upset that some of their customers' rights were being stepped on? Tiffany, we'll start with you.
Sure. So that was an initial concern. There was a lot of back and forth. Nobody really knew what to expect. The good news is that it's been given a decade to work. We now know that it does work. There's no negative economic impact to the hospitality industry. And in fact, there's actually been a positive impact in most instances.
Yeah, and I think that concern at the time might have had some validity, but it also didn't really address the needs of a lot of people who work in the restaurant industry and in the food service industry that didn't really have as much say in what was happening.
Yeah, was the argument more focused on the workers than on the customers, per se? The customers could choose to come or not come, depending on what sort of a venue it was, smoking or not smoking, but the people who were in there 8 hours or whatever, an extended period of time, was that the focus of much of the argument?
I think the focus was really on the smokers losing perceived rights.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing to remember with the Clean Indoor Air Act is that it's not a ban on smoking. It's not an attack against smokers. It's really about increasing protection for workers. There's tens of thousands of individuals that are working in the hospitality industry that have no choice but to inhale toxic air for 8 or more hours a day. You know, it's been proven there is no risk-free level of exposure to secondhand smoke, and there's also a risk of third-hand smoke. These workers are then bringing home these toxic chemicals on their clothing and their bodies, and they're sharing them with their families and children as well.
All right. So it turned out to be a compromise, a lot of exemptions for some businesses and organizations, bars with 20% or less of revenue from food, casinos up to 50% of the gaming floors, and some other ones like tobacco shops and cigar bars. But those were a couple of the main venues with exemptions. Do we have any sense, has there been any study how about the impact on restaurants, the area that you cover, their bottom line? Have we seen anything?
I mean, as far as I know, and this is just through hearing people's experiences and talking to people and being out myself, that there is no effect on this. It's not that restaurants and bars that ban smoking suddenly lost their entire customer base and there's been a rash of bars that have closed. I think if anything, you look at Pittsburgh in the news now and people say, what a great bar scene we have, what a great brewery scene we have. And a lot of those places that people talk about are non-smoking venues. So I don't think there's any evidence that by, you know, continuing this through to include all bars and restaurants and casinos, that it's going to destroy any business at all. And I think if you look at other states as well, I remember living in California when this ban first passed in 1998, you know, January 1st, and people said, oh, the bars are going to close. And there's no evidence that that's happened at all.
Yeah, other states actually have done comprehensive studies and have seen quite an increase. New York, there was a 9% increase in tax revenue from sales in the hospitality industry, and Colorado saw as much of a 20% increase.
But what sort of a time frame do you know, Tiffany, we're talking about?
I believe that was the year immediately following implementation of the Clean Indoor Air Act legislation.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any sense, were there contributing factors like, well, population just grew in this region, so more people were going to go to restaurants. Did they do a deep dive or just took a look at the bottom line, the revenues from year to year?
So what they looked at was the tax revenue from the hospitality industry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now all told, I've mentioned some of the exemptions, bars 20% or less of food as their business, and the casinos up to 50% of the gaming floors. About 2,300 establishments are exempt in Pennsylvania, about that number right now. According to the Pennsylvania Alliance to Control Tobacco, since the Clean Indoor Air Act took effect, a study of air quality in the state's hospitality industry found that indoor air pollution levels in the smoke-free venues declined by nearly 90%. So it's worked?
It works. The American Lung Association has also estimated that annually about 52 lives of hospitality workers will be saved.
What have you taken? I mean, how you these are people. This is your area of expertise. What you cover. I mean, is there any lingering resentment, or it's just nope? That's the law now. That's the way it goes.
I mean, every bartender that I spoke to about this says that they would prefer working in a smoke-free workplace. And I think, you know, one of the things I've read a lot in the last couple of days about this proposal, a lot of the pushback is, well, why don't they just go get another job somewhere else? And I think that really devalues the workforce in it, and it assumes that these workers don't deserve the same rights as any other worker. And I think that's a real shame.
Well, let me follow up on that. You said every bartender you talked to, were these bartenders in restaurants that have no exemptions, so unless they must abide by and adhere to the Clean Air Indoor Air Act, or are these at 20% and below where smoking is still allowed?
They were both. I think that there are probably some bartenders. You know, I obviously didn't talk to every bartender in the region.
You don't?
No, I mean, I talked to a lot though. But I'm sure there are some bartenders that that enjoy working at a bar where they can light up a cigarette. But I think, again, you know, I think the percentage of bartenders that want to smoke in a bar is so low as compared to the percentage of bartenders that want to be able to have a dignified workplace where they can work in a place where they can, you know, go home and not smell of smoke, not have their lungs, you know, clogged and feel great about what they do.
Mm-hmm. Tiffany, does your organization reach out to whether it's the workers or customers to sort of get a pulse of what they're feeling?
So that really is handled by PACT, like you had mentioned, the Pennsylvania right. Alliance to Control Tobacco. They do a lot of consumer research work and a lot of advocacy work surrounding the Clean Indoor Air Act and some other things. But the anecdotal evidence that I have really is that the majority of individuals want to work in an environment free from air pollution and free from toxins. And that, you know, there's been a big emphasis on bartenders. Tobacco and drinking tend to kind of go hand in hand. But it's not just bartenders. It's also hotel staff, people on the casino floor. There's a lot of individuals that are currently being affected by this.
Okay. At a recent press conference, State Representative Dan Frankel is supporting some changes to the current law, further restrictions. Dan Frankel is from Pittsburgh. He called on his colleagues in the legislature to remove exemptions.
Workers in industries, including hospitality, healthcare, and gaming, lack basic protections from the law. We've given the law a decade to work. We know it does. Now it deserves to work for absolutely everybody in Pennsylvania.
All right. Tiffany, and Hal, you alluded to it a little bit earlier. So if it's worked, why are these additional changes? Why are these additional restrictions needed? Or what you're hearing from people in the industry? We'll start with you, Tiffany.
They're definitely needed because there's still a large percentage of the population that's not being protected. Everyone has the right to breathe clean air. And like we said, we do know that it works. There's two big loopholes that are holding it back from working better. One would be the 2,300 plus exemptions that are still in effect in the state of Pennsylvania. The other would be the preemption that individual municipalities and communities are unable to set their own regulations, that it really does have to be a statewide effort, which takes a lot of communication and coordination.
Mm-hmm. Now, Hal, we've established that you go to some establishments in reporting that are still exempt. Getting any feedback on these proposed removals of those exemptions?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think, you know, last year I worked on a story about bartenders who had been working at the same establishment for 25 years or more. And a lot of them, even at that time, I asked, you know, like, are you happy that they're smoking here? And they said, no, you know, we deal with it, we accept it, but we don't really like it. And I think, you know, if you look at someone that's had the same job for 25 years, you can't just ask them to leave their job and go somewhere else because they want to, you know, because they don't like the smoking. So I think what you're really doing is you're empowering people to be able to work in a smoke-free workplace and to do that. And I think, you know, like I said, most bartenders want that and they want to see that. And also, I think when you go to bars, even when there are bars that a customer can smoke in an establishment, you don't really see the bartender smoking anyway. So I don't think this is something that's going to affect the day-to-day of their operations other than some, that in a positive way.
All right, that's the bartender. What about their bosses, though? I mean, it's their bottom line. Any sense of how they're feeling about proposed removal of exemptions?
I mean, again, like this is anecdotally, but I know from a consumer perspective, I know significantly more people that say, I don't want to go to bar X because I don't want to come home smelling like an ashtray than I do people saying, I will never go to that bar if I can't smoke in there. So I don't think there's really any evidence that bars that are smoker friendly at the moment are going to suffer a lot of business. I think if anything, they might draw more customers in that ordinarily wouldn't go to their bar. Or, you know, I know from my perspective, sometimes I make a choice. Okay, well, you know, tonight I can deal with that. I don't really want to, but my friends are there. And I think it's going to make it a lot easier for me to just say, yes, I'd love to meet you at this bar.
So clarify for me. So even if the state legislature just sort of doesn't act or just lets this sit, really local leaders, they can't really pass ordinances to remove exemptions here because the state has control. Is that not because they really put the foot down on Allegheny County's ordinance, which was stronger than the current state ordinance?
Yeah, that's correct. It does have to be a statewide movement. There's currently two bills that have been proposed. There's House Bill 1309 and Senate Bill 519. The best thing that I can suggest is that individuals reach out to their local representatives. That it needs to gather some support, needs to gather traction. The good news is that no one person can make any sort of legislation like this, but the representatives want to hear from the communities, and people do have a voice in what moves forward.
Is there any sense, though, that this could get passed? Or is this, I mean, one of many pieces of legislation that are proposed and then just sit around? Do we have any sense that it could get passed?
Absolutely, it's possible. And again, it's really up to the will of the people. That's the whole point of a democracy. So I would encourage anyone who feels strongly on either side to reach out to their state representatives and tell them that they support this and why.
At the same time of that news briefing, we heard that clip from State Representative Dan Frankel marking the 10th anniversary of the Clean Indoor Air Act. Thomas Hanses, Pennsylvania commander of the VFW, said that the VFW post in Morningside decided to ban smoking. So individual businesses and organizations can decide that currently have exemptions. So if the local government officials can't adopt ordinances, and if the state leaders decide not to take action on these legislative proposals, why not try from, you know, from the grassroots level to get one at a time to say, you know what, for our customers, for our workers, it's probably best if, even though we are entitled to this exemption, maybe we should ban it ourselves.
There are a lot of bars in the region that choose to ban smoking already. I think it's really an issue of people that work in establishments where the ownership has decided to, you know, put their foot down and not ban smoking from indoors, that the legislation's needed. I mean, I think there is opportunity for grassroots activism and opportunities for customers and workers to say, we don't want this here. But I think at the end of the day, having that legislation is going to protect workers in places where the ownership might still want to allow smoking because maybe they still believe that that's going to attract more business or for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. Tiffany, your organization, does it do sort of get people energized that way rather than waiting for the state legislature to take action, say, hey, you know what? You can do this on your own. VFW, why don't you consider not allowing smoking? Do you go at the grassroots level?
Absolutely, we do. One of the really great programs that we have is our worksite tobacco cessation policies, where we can actually go into somebody's worksite, help them write policies that would mimic the Clean Indoor Air Act legislation, and then we can work with their staff, their employees, so anybody who's currently smoking that would like to quit.
And final quick question. We have just 30 seconds. You know, the rights of the workers versus the rights of the customers. I want to go have a drink, have a smoke. Why shouldn't I be able to do so?
Well, I think as a customer, you can go outside and have a smoke. And I think as a worker, you have to stay inside. And so I think that really spells it out for me.
Yeah, when it comes down to it, it's about protecting workers. And everybody has the right to breathe clean air. Just as there's no opt-out for sanitation or cleanliness, there's no opt-out for clean air as well.
Tiffany Babinczak is the program coordinator at Tobacco Free Allegheny. Reporter Hal Klein covers the restaurant scene in the region for Pittsburgh Magazine. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And for today, that's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, we'll talk with the executive director of the Women's Center and Shelter of Greater Pittsburgh about efforts to crack down on domestic violence. What's the holdup? Kyla Kaczynski engineered today's program. Production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.